if you were to take a survey of all the people close to you, then you would probably find that they share similar core values, political affiliations, education, and come from similar social and economic classes. When you get around someone who doesn't support your worldview, it usually triggers your defenses. Whether you know it or not, your brain is saying, I don't want that person around. They scare me. I want them far away because I want to be comfortable in my belief bubble. It's human nature to maintain your comfort zone. Nevertheless, as natural as it is, this fear-based normal is a major problem. Instinctive reactions to pain do not bring out the best in human beings. On a social level, oppression, injustice, racism, war, and most other social evils can be traced back to the instinctive fear of people who are different. On a personal level, fear-based reactions cause most misunderstandings and hurt in relationships. If you want to preserve relationships, then you must learn to respond instead of react to fear and pain. Responding does not come naturally. You can react without thinking, but you cannot respond without training your mind to think, your will to choose, and your body to obey. It is precisely this training that brings the best qualities in human beings, like courage, empathy, reason, compassion, justice, and generosity, to the surface. The ability to exercise these qualities and respond gives you other options besides disconnection in the face of relational pain. Powerful people are not slaves to their instincts. Powerful people can respond with love in the face of fear and pain. This responsibility is essential to building healthy relationships. Created for freedom. In order to begin training yourself to respond in love, the first thing you need to accept is this truth. You cannot control other people. The only person you can control on a good day is yourself. This is a fundamental principle of human freedom. We were designed to be free. How do we know this? God put two trees in the garden. He gave us a choice. Without choice, we don't have freedom. And more importantly, we don't have love, which requires freedom. God chose us, loves us, and wants us to choose Him and love Him in return. So He gave us a free choice, even though it necessarily meant risking our rejection and the devastation of a disconnected relationship. The tragedy of the fall actually proclaims that He does not want to control us. He didn't control us in the garden, and He doesn't want to control us now. Many people find this difficult to believe. If you were raised with a powerless, fear-driven mindset based on the belief that you can control people and they can control you, then you will naturally perceive God as a controlling punisher. You will take the laws of the Old Testament, all the verses and stories about wrath, judgment, and the fear of the Lord, and conclude, see, God wants to control us, and we need to be controlled. Our hearts are desperately wicked, and we can't be trusted. So God uses the threat of punishment to maintain the distance between us and Him. The problem is that the Bible does not show us a God who is pursuing the goal of distance between Himself and a bunch of scary sinners. Instead, the Bible reveals a God who is relentlessly closing that distance and paying the ultimate price to repair the disconnection we created in our relationship. God's number one goal with us is connection, and nothing, neither pain nor death, will prevent Him from moving toward us and responding to us with love. His perfect love for us is absolutely fearless. He is not afraid of us, and He never will be. His gospel message is, I love you no matter what. I'm not afraid of your mistakes, and you don't have to be afraid of them either. You don't have to be afraid of other people's mistakes. They may be painful. Many things in this life may be painful. But pain and the fear of pain no longer have the power to control you. You are always free to choose. So, what are you going to do? God is continually moving toward you in love and giving you the choice to love Him. He never takes your choices away. 2 Corinthians 3:17 says, where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. The more God fills your life, the more freedom you'll end up having. Fear is your enemy. While God is not afraid of sin or sinners, most of us are. We're afraid of people's mistakes, and we're afraid of our own. It's no wonder our entire society, including our court system, is set up in such a way that fear and punishment are the solutions to bad behavior. As long as we operate out of fear, we will inevitably continue to reproduce distance and disconnection in our relationships with God, others, and ourselves. The cycle can only be broken by repenting from the lie that we can control other people and by accepting the truth that we must control ourselves. As soon as you begin to believe this truth and stop trying to control people, you're going to be confronted with a lot of resistance from the old normal, and it won't give way to heaven's normal without a fight. Remember how hard it was for Dave to tell me that he loved his wife. The minute he turned from the goal of distance and disconnection to the goal of connection, he was plunged into a battle against fear. This is because fear and love are enemies. They come from two opposing kingdoms. Fear comes from the devil, who would like nothing more than to keep you permanently disconnected and isolated. Love comes from God, who is always working to heal and restore your connections with Him and other people and bring you into healthy, life-giving relationships. Fear and love have opposite agendas and opposite strategies for achieving them. They cannot coexist in a person, relationship, or culture. God is very clear that the spirit He put in you is not the spirit of fear, but the spirit of love. You've not been given a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and a sound mind. He's also clear that partnering with the spirit of love is the way to displace fear in your life. John wrote, "There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear, because fear has to do with punishment. The one who fears is not made perfect in love." If you want to partner with the Holy Spirit, then you must have a strict, no-tolerance policy about fear and punishment in your life and relationships. It doesn't matter how long you've used those tools, they have got to go. Learning to partner with the Spirit of love requires you to become powerful. This is a serious challenge. When Paul told Timothy that the Spirit of love is also the Spirit of power and a sound mind, he implied that its opposite, the spirit of fear, is the spirit of powerlessness and a weak, divided mind. When you grow up partnering with the spirit of fear, as most of us do, you learn to simply hand over your brain and your power, letting fear take control. But as soon as you decide to partner with the spirit of love, you have to think and make powerful choices. Dave and Anne couldn't even remember making a decision to listen to fear and turn their love off. But in order to turn their love back on, they had to marshal their internal resources to think, decide, and act. They had to become powerful and exercise self-control in order to say, "Yes, I love my spouse." The choice Dave and Anne made to turn their love on in my office that day was, in a way, even more powerful than the choice they made to get married in the first place, because they made it after experiencing a history of pain with one another. They no longer had illusions about the worst fear and pain could bring out in them. They knew that their choice to love one another could not be conditioned by what the other person did or did not do, and that it had to be strong enough to withstand the fear and pain that derailed them in the past. They understood better than before just how powerful they needed to be to make that choice. And wonderfully, they decided to be powerful, to respond in love and cast out fear in their relationship. What a change. Controlling ourselves towards connection. Do you want to win the battle between fear and love in your relationships? You can start by making these two fundamental commitments. Number one, it's my job to control myself. I do not get to control other people. Number two, my number one goal and priority in relationship is building and protecting connection. These commitments are among the most powerful choices you can make, and they will require more of you than anything you can imagine. But the person you will become and the relationships you will be capable of experiencing as a result are absolutely worth the investment. After making these commitments, you will need to acquire several skill sets in order to follow through with them. First, as we explored in the last chapter, you need to be able to communicate love consistently in ways that people can hear and receive. This sounds simple, But if you've grown up in a fear-based, love-starved relational culture, it can be revolutionary to break the silence and start actively communicating what has been one of your best-kept secrets. I love you. My relationship with you is really important to me. In a SOZO session, it is common to uncover the fact that the individual was raised by a parent who couldn't or wouldn't say, I love you. Often this person has spent their entire life blowing off this glaring omission, trying to accept by faith that his mother or father really loved them. Oh, I know my dad loved me. He had a hard time saying it. He never said it to anybody, but I knew. He was my dad. He loved me. Of course, the person is sitting in the SOZO because dad's silence allowed anxiety to persist in their relationship and weaken their connection. The pain of this disconnection is why the person is a mess. If you want to cast out all the fear in your relationships, then you need to leave no room for doubt in people's minds and hearts that you truly love them. It's amazing how much you can strengthen a relational connection and resolve relational problems by simply speaking in one another's love languages. Each display of love, no matter how seemingly small, is a powerful act of spiritual warfare that removes anxiety from the environment, replaces it with freedom and safety, and invites each person to bring his or her best self forward in the relationship. Never forget that scared people are bound to show you their worst. People who feel loved, on the other hand, will usually show you their best. As you manage your love towards others and pursue the goal of connection, you will need feedback so you can understand how you are affecting them and identify where you need to make adjustments. You will also need to offer the same kind of feedback to them. This is where the second skill set for building connection comes in, communication. We will explore this skill set more fully in the second section of this book. But now, I'll say that healthy communication is all about providing someone with honest, relevant information about how their behavior is affecting your life. It's not about judging them or telling them how they need to change. It is about trusting them to do whatever they need to do to protect and nourish your connection and letting them know that you will do the same. God practices healthy communication with you. In Psalm 32:8, David speaks for God thus, I will instruct you and teach you in a way you should go. I will guide you with my eye. This sounds a little strange at first. How is God going to lead you with his eyeball? He can't control you with his eyeball. And that's the point. What he can do with his eye is show you how he feels about the choices you are making and how they are affecting his heart. The eyes are the windows to the heart. When God shows us how your choices affect his heart and your connection with him, then you get to choose how you will respond to this information. Will you adjust, if necessary, in order to protect your connection with him? That is the real test of a healthy relationship. The third and final skill set you need in order to control yourself and pursue the goal of connection, which we will explore in the final section of this book, is a new plan for dealing with the things that threaten your connections. You need to have a punishment-free, control-free, fear-free plan for dealing with people who make mistakes, engaging in conflict, and setting healthy boundaries. Your success in this plan is fully determined by how powerful you are willing to become. Will you become a person who can keep your love on no matter what? A powerful person says, I'm going to be okay no matter what you do. You can hurt me, but you cannot make me turn my love off. I am relentlessly going to do what I have to do to protect my connection with you no matter what. When you can say and do this in the face of fear, mistakes, and pain, you have already won the battle between fear and love. Chapter 4. Building Healthy Relationships. My wife Sherry and I are a testimony of the power of choosing to keep love on against all odds. Both my parents were married 3 times. Sherry's mom and dad were each married 3 times as well, and her stepfather, who raised her from the time she was 2 years old, was also married 3 times. Between our 2 sets of parents, there are 15 marriages. Each one obviously affected our lives as a couple. So, when the time came for Sherry and I to get married, we sought premarital counseling from Bill Johnson. There was no such thing as a pre-marriage class back then. Our counseling consisted of 2 private sessions with Pastor Bill. During the first session, we took a test called the Taylor-Johnson Compatibility Assessment. In the second session, we went over the test results. Supposedly, everything looked okay, so we decided to get married. 12 years later, Sherry and I sat in Bill's living room discussing the opportunity to be associate pastors at Mountain Chapel in Weaverville. Somehow, the topic of our marriage came up, and Bill scratched his chin. "This reminds me of that note that was on your assessment," he said. "What note?" I asked. He looked at me expectantly. "That Taylor Johnson thing we did in your pre-married counseling sessions. Remember that note that was on it when it came back?" Sherry and I both drew blanks. No. I didn't tell you about the note?" he asked, looking confused. Sherry and I leaned towards him. Both of us were keenly interested if this note would answer years of questions swirling around in our marriage. "What note? You didn't tell them?" Benny, Bill's wife, asked in disbelief. "Tell us what?" Sherry and I prodded. "Oh, that's weird," Bill said. "I thought I told you about it a while ago. Well, for 10 years, I gave that assessment to couples and sent them off to a psychologist. He ran them through his computer and then mailed me the results." "Okay," Sherry nodded, urging him on. "When I got your test back, it came with a post-it note on it. The first time in 10 years there's ever been a post-it note. The psychologist explained that the test shows the points where two lives are supposed to touch incompatibility in order to predict a successful relationship. Well, you two did not touch at any point. You have parallel lines. According to that test, you are completely incompatible." I felt my eyes bugging out of my head. Bill kept going, oblivious to our astonishment. "According to the psychologist, between the differences in your personalities and the 15 marriages that had gone on before you, your chances of success are negligible." His post-it note said something to this effect: "Do whatever you can to stop these two human beings from being in the same house together." It felt like a small bomb had gone off. We stared at each other in shock, trying to absorb the fact that A, some psychologist had warned us not to get married, and B, Bill had not told us. It was a pretty funny moment, looking back. Finally, I said, "Well, Bill, that helps explain why the first decade of our marriage was hell. Our first 12 years of marriage were spent in a constant struggle. Sherry and I came up against serious challenges created by our vastly different personalities, broken relational histories, and natural human fears. There were plenty of moments where we could have decided we'd had enough because it just wasn't working. But we both chose to stay invested in our connection and to keep trying. We chose to embrace the unique things that made us different and learned what unconditional love and acceptance could produce when two people refuse to give up on each other. Bill must have known deep down not to give us that note. I can tell you now that what Sherry and I have created is a beautiful thing. If that psychologist could only see us now. The connection we have built and the life we enjoy together keeps getting better and better. Our marriage is a miracle in every way. Thanks to my journey with Sherry, I have more hope than anyone else I know for people who are going through marital problems. If you are blessed to grow up in a healthy relational environment, then it is possible for you to simply inherit good relational tools, never really appreciating just how powerful and costly they are. But when, as Sherry and I did, you have to pay the price to go find these tools after receiving a pile of dangerous broken tools from your family environment, then you have a different perspective. Acquiring the tools and wisdom to build a healthy connection in our marriage was like discovering the polio vaccine. Learning to make the reversals we have discussed in the previous chapters, from powerless to powerful, from control to self-control, from the goal of distance to the goal of connection, and from fear to love, were nothing short of revolutionary. And we are supremely confident that anyone can make these reversals and build or restore healthy, intimate connections in their lives, even after years of disconnection and brokenness. The Foundation: Unconditional Love and Acceptance. Healthy relationships truly are the most valuable, meaningful, and satisfying of human experiences. But what are the qualities that make up a healthy relational connection? If you don't know, then you won't be able to assess whether or not your relational practices are helping to build and strengthen a connection. Like a house, a relational connection needs to have specific elements to complete its structure, or it will be unsafe and vulnerable to disaster. As with all houses, Building starts with the foundation. The foundation of a healthy relationship is an agreement to practice unconditional acceptance and unconditional love. Unconditional acceptance says, you are not me and I am not you. You get to be you and I get to be me in this relationship. This does not mean you have to unconditionally accept one another's behaviors. Rather, it means that you do not control one another. Not controlling someone while accepting his or her negative behaviors looks something like this. Imagine my son has been playing in the backyard and happens to step in doggy doo. I don't want his shoes to touch my carpet, so I meet him at the back door. Son, I say, feel free to come in the house once the dog mess is gone. You can take your shoes off or wash your shoes off. Dad, I love you. Take your time. My voice is calm and I have a smile on my face. Not wanting dog mess in the house doesn't mean I don't want my son in the house. I separate him from the mess. I can love him and still require him to eliminate the mess before he comes inside. He may try to force his way in. However, I can assure you, people can't force their way into my house or into my trust, vulnerability, or intimacy. I'm the only person who allows people into my house. This is not controlling someone else. This is controlling myself. Unconditional love says, no matter what you do, I'm going to pursue the goal of connection with you. Anxiety naturally arises when personal differences show up in a relationship, and fear will tempt us to run away from each other. But in committing to unconditional love, we commit to keep moving toward each other even when we're scared. We will do whatever it is we need to do to protect our connection. Sometimes you have to be willing to agree to disagree over something in order to maintain your connection. My relationship with an old and dear friend was almost destroyed over our different opinions on a certain moral issue. However, we decided to put our relationship first and be at peace, even though we approached the issue in opposite ways. We still don't agree, but we don't let our disagreements create a wedge in our connection. Conditional love and acceptance means that we are willing to pull away from our connection under certain circumstances. The minute we happen to scare the other person or they scare us, we will be tempted to withhold our love and disconnect. And because disconnection only produces more fear and anxiety, we will widen our distance at an alarming rate. This threat effectively prevents two people from feeling free to be themselves because they instinctively know the connection won't be strong enough to handle it. In contrast, when we commit to unconditional love and acceptance, we protect each other's freedom. Everything that we offer to the relationship comes freely from our heart, not under coercion. Yes, committing to pursue and protect my connection with you means that I will be thinking about how my decisions will affect you while making adjustments accordingly. But managing myself to protect our connection is the ultimate expression of freedom. That is what it means to be a powerful person. Without a foundation of unconditional love and acceptance in a relationship, we simply cannot be free to be ourselves. It's only when we remove the option of distance and disconnection from our relationships that we can create a safe place to be ourselves. We cast out fear, inviting each other to bring our best selves forward. Yes, it's vulnerable and scary to keep your love on towards someone who has become a perceived threat. You cannot guarantee what he or she is going to do. But you can guarantee your own choice, and you can always choose connection. Seven pillars of healthy relationships. The foundation of unconditional love and acceptance determines the longevity and resilience of a relational connection. This foundation consistently supports the other elements that make up a healthy relationship, elements I've dubbed the seven pillars. In Proverbs 9:1, we read, "Wisdom has built her house, she has hewn her seven pillars." The house of wisdom represents the kingdom of God, the domain where God's ultimate reality is expressed in its perfect design. At the center of this kingdom is the dynamic and perfect relationship of the Trinity, which sets the pattern for all relationships. The pillars that hold up this house represent the core values of kingdom life, the core values of healthy relationships. These core values are love, honor, self-control, responsibility, truth, faith, and vision. The pillar of love. Love is a word of many meanings. We use it to talk about our favorite sports, foods, hobbies, and movies. We also read 1 Corinthians 13:13, "The greatest of these is love," and acknowledge that love is the biggest, most important, and most powerful thing in the universe. So, what does love mean in the context of a relationship? The pillar of love is comprised of a commitment, an action, and a result. The commitment part is this: I care about you and value you, all of you. I care about your soul, spirit, body, relationships, dreams, and destiny. The action part is demonstrating care and value in many ways and in many situations as you get to know a person over time. And the result of these actions is that the person feels loved. They feel safe, valued, connected, nourished, protected, and understood. I knew a young couple that had one of those classic mother-in-law problems. The husband's mother and his wife had a constant power struggle because the husband had trouble setting boundaries with his mother. Then, right before the wife was about to give birth to their third child, his mother called and asked if she could move in for a while. The husband finally listened to his wife and had a rather difficult but necessary "you can't stay here" conversation with his mother. For one of the first times in their married life, his wife felt safe, protected, and loved during a situation involving his mother. If your love isn't producing things like safety, peace, and trust in your relationships, it probably shouldn't be called love. There are millions of people around the world who call what they have in a relationship love. Looking closer, you find that they are people who cannot fully be themselves because it's not safe. They consistently withhold things and set conditions based on what they will give up to the other person. If you want to test the quality of love in a relationship, then you need to ask one another, do you feel safe? Do you feel cared for? Do you feel valued and significant? Do you feel protected? Do you feel pursued and known? Remember, perfect love casts out fear. The most immediate sign that the pillar of love is growing strong in your relationship is that all fear is leaving as courage, freedom, and safety are felt and expressed. The pillar of honor. Honor, like submission, is a term that has been misused and abused, particularly in the connection with marriage. People see it as something that is expected rather than something that is given. This is backwards. When honor is expected or even demanded, it becomes just another word for handing the control, power, and value over to one person in the relationship. A relationship where one person has all the power is one of dishonor, not honor. God modeled honor when he transformed us from slaves to friends, from orphans to sons. He stooped low to bring us to his level. He used his power to make us powerful, insisting that we become equal partners in his plan to bring heaven to earth. This is the pattern for honor in relationships. True honor is the practice of two powerful people putting one another before themselves, empowering one another, working together to meet one another's needs, and adjusting as necessary in order to move together toward the shared goals of the relationship. Honor is also the practice of calling out the best in one another. This can be expressed both in words of praise, "you're amazing," and in words of correction, "hey, you are way too awesome to be acting like that. Remember who you are and stop it." I remember when my son Taylor was struggling to get a job. He was living on his own. He had a few jobs here and there, but for the most part was unemployed. I found out that he wasn't doing his best to get a job, so I let him know I wasn't going to help him financially anymore. "Dad," he complained, "it's just been really hard to find a job." "Son, you are Taylor Silk," I said. "You can do whatever you want to do. Remember who you are. If you want a job, you can get a job." After he stopped protesting, he thanked me for believing in him and went out and got a job within a week. Honor allows us to keep high levels of value and faith in people, even when they demonstrate how different from us they are, which can be scary, and when they make mistakes, which can also be scary. Typically, people allow differences and mistakes to lower their respect and value for other people. But you know the pillar of honor is strong in a relationship when you can look at the other person and say, "You are really different from me. It makes me sad, when I see you making that choice. But I love you, I value you, and I believe in you, and I am here for you in our relationship. The pillar of self-control. Self-control is at the core of being a powerful person. Self-control means that you can tell yourself what to do, and you can make yourself do it. It sounds simple enough, but telling yourself what to do and obeying yourself can be quite an accomplishment. For most of us, it's a good day when we obey ourselves. In order for us to practice self-control, we must have a goal. We must have something we are saying yes to, which necessarily comes with things that we must say no to. We use self-control to maneuver ourselves towards this yes. This goal must be entirely our own. The minute another person is choosing and managing our goals for us, we have left self-control behind. When I practice self-control in a relationship, I take full responsibility for managing my love and pursuing my goal of connection. If I ever turn my love off towards you, it is 100% my fault, no matter what you have done. Self-control removes the option of blaming others for our choices. When two people show one another that they are able to control themselves on a consistent basis, they demonstrate that they are reliable and trustworthy. You can tell that the pillar of self-control is strong in a relationship when you don't have to spend time wondering whether or not the other person will follow through on something they said they would do. Conversely, a lack of self-control creates anxiety in a relationship because you cannot trust one another to manage yourselves towards your goals. For example, say a young man gets a great job, his dream job. The job involves a lot of unsupervised time, but his boss trusts him to manage his time and work without needing to hover over him. Around the time he gets this job, this young man gets a girlfriend. As time progresses, he allows Miss Girlfriend to take up more and more time and puts his awesome job on the back burner. Work piles up, stressing him, his boss, and everyone else who depends on him doing what he said he was going to do. The end result is a jeopardized job and a jeopardized relationship with his boss. We must learn how to manage our freedom. When we find ourselves with more freedom than self-control, then that freedom erodes the quality of our life and friendships. Self-control is what allows us to manage increasing levels of freedom in our life and relationships. The pillar of responsibility. When we break the word responsibility down, we find that it literally means ability to respond. If you remember, a response is the opposite of a reaction. Responsibility is the capacity to face any situation and make powerful choices that are consistent with who you say you are. It is a refusal to run away from difficulties or any part of your life or reality that you happen to dislike. When you take full ownership of your life in this way, you gain confidence and momentum in making good decisions. Say you decide to spend a day driving around New York City. You pick up your rental car at JFK and follow the signs to Manhattan. You know you want to get from the Brooklyn Bridge to Central Park, but you don't have a map. At each intersection, you crane your neck and read the street signs, senses on high alert in the swirl of honking taxis and pedestrians. Every 100 feet or so, you must make another decision about where to go, which becomes more and more difficult as you realize you have no idea where you are. Pretty soon, your anxiety levels are spiked into crisis territory because you're having such a difficult time responding to your environment. But what if you head into New York with a GPS that tells you, turn left in 300 feet, drive 3 miles, and arrive at your destination on the left? Your anxiety stays low because you trust that your GPS is going to lead you down the right path. If you make a mistake, you can count on it to show you a different route. You're able to respond to your circumstances and get where you want to go. When the pillar of responsibility is strong in a relationship, it's like having a GPS. You are both confident and relaxed because you have a plan, an inner compass, that can be relied on to help you respond with love and powerful choices in any circumstance. This plan grows out of your core commitments to control yourself, cast out fear with love, and pursue the goal of connection. It's very powerful when two people can look at one another and know that no matter what happens, each of you knows what you're going to choose to do. Banning Leibscher, founder of Jesus Culture, is a great example of a man with a plan, vision, and mission for his life. Let's just say he has one powerful internal GPS. Throughout the course of his life, he has had many opportunities to compromise or divert his life and energies away from his calling. But he has such an intense focus and personal responsibility for his mission that he has experienced enormous success at a young age. Furthermore, he has not been overwhelmed or distracted due to his ability to respond to his abundance in the right way. He has weathered many storms and strengthened his covenant relationships because of his commitment to God's purposes in the unfolding of his intentional life. That is what life looks like when the pillar of responsibility is strong. The pillar of truth. When I ask people to write down a list of qualities they want in their relationships, I almost always see trust or trustworthiness somewhere close to the top. However, for many people, trust means I need to be able to anticipate your decisions. I need to know that you would do what I would do. On one level, that's absolutely right. Two people in a relationship need to be on the same page about who they are and what they are going after. But if trust hinges on my ability to anticipate your behavior, then our connection is going to be threatened. Every time you do something that I would never do, I begin to think, I didn't anticipate that. You aren't acting like me. I would never do that to you. Did you really just bring that into our relationship? How could you do that? I can't trust you now. This version of trust quickly turns to mistrust, which is just another word for fear, the enemy of love and connection. Incidentally, many people get disillusioned and hurt when God does not do what they think he should have done. Because they could not predict his behavior, they decide not to trust him. Does that mean God's not trustworthy? Absolutely not. If the perfect one is not trustworthy, then how can imperfect people ever be trustworthy? We have to be able to trust people even when they do things we wouldn't do, or we will end up very isolated. Two people who walk through life together are always going to be getting to know one another on some level. Life is not static or contained. There will always be mystery, unexpected circumstances to face, and fresh seasons of growth. So we need a pillar in our relationships that makes room for this, the pillar of truth. The pillar of truth sustains trust in a relationship. Like all the other pillars, truth is built through powerful choices, choices that are all about what you're going to do, not about what the other person is going to do. I don't demand your trust. I display trust by telling you the truth. I crack open my chest and show you what's going on inside of me. I choose to show you what I am experiencing in my relationship with you, no matter what. Each time I do that, I leave you with good information, and you get to make better decisions because now you can see me. Practicing truth is a very vulnerable thing to do, but is absolutely necessary when building any relationship worth keeping. When we allow patterns of mistrust and hiding ourselves to develop in our relationships, we end up having conversations like this. What's wrong? Nothing. Like you care. What? I do care. Tell me what's going on. What is the problem? You want to know the problem? You are the problem. You just walk by me and don't even say hi. All day long, every time I see you, nothing. And you say you care? You don't care about anybody but yourself. We call this an exchange of truth, but actually, I've told you nothing about me. I've only told you four things that are wrong with you. I'm not really being vulnerable and showing you my heart. I'm judging you. A conversation where truth is being exchanged would sound a little different. What's wrong? Well, basically, I got hurt. I'm feeling hurt about our lack of connection, and I've been swimming in it all day. I'm hurting, and my thoughts are all over the place. Do you want me to share more? Now I've cracked open my chest, and you get to decide what you are going to do. If you decide to meet me halfway and we exchange more truth, that's awesome. But even if you don't, I still control my truth. I will show you my truth and demonstrate trust regardless of your actions. Jesus manages his trust in ways that scare the pants off of most of us. Think about this. On the night his disciples would betray and abandon him, he brought them around the Last Supper table and said, "Let's make a covenant." What kind of person says, "Hey, you betrayers, come get closer. Let me deepen my covenant with you right before you break yours with me." Someone who really knows how to manage his trust. That's who. The pillar of faith. Many addiction recovery programs teach people that they need to pursue a connection with God if they want to break out of the bondage from a substance or activity. This aspect of recovery acknowledges that the other side of our human instinct to avoid pain is our instinct to grab hold of things that calm our anxiety and make us feel better. Things that bring us comfort, safety, and pleasure. We have a deep, God-created need for intimacy, love, and comfort. But if we look to things that are not designed to meet these things and elevate them above everything else, making them idols, then the result is always bondage and destruction. It's only when we place God at the center that we can access the comfort, peace, safety, joy, and pleasure that truly meets our deepest needs. Only faith in the one who made us can make us truly free. When you put a person in the position of God, you set them up for failure. Think of a man who makes his wife his God. He makes her responsible for his joy, identity, and comfort. All these things that only God should satisfy. Inevitably, his anxiety goes through the roof whenever he can't control her. He has put her in charge of such deep needs in his life that he becomes scared of her. She is his addiction. And when he can't get his fix, he ends up in a mess. His only hope is to turn to God. God must satisfy his needs. No one else can do that God job like God can. Mysterious as it is, making ourselves accountable to God and putting ourselves under his authority is the only way we can become powerful and learn to govern ourselves. The founding fathers of the United States understood this very well. They taught that a free society is only free because individuals submit themselves by faith to divine authority and a code of virtue. The moment you remove faith from a society, you remove the possibility of self-government. When people refuse to be accountable to God, the only answer is to control them externally through systems of punishment that take away their freedom. The pillar of faith is built in a relationship as two people commit to keep God as their ultimate source, ultimate comforter, and ultimate authority. The result of this commitment is that both people are able to govern themselves and access a boundless well of spiritual resources, wisdom, strength, love, hope, etc., to sustain them in moving toward their relational goals. When two people are consistently pursuing a connection with the perfect one, that connection will set the pace for their connection with each other. They will be learning to love from love himself, which can only bring out the best in their relationship. The pain and fear that comes from being disconnected in a relationship usually leaves you feeling powerless to do anything about it. Unless Sherry and I turn our attention to God after an argument, we feel controlled or despondent in our distance. Over and over again after we disconnect, we turn our attention to God until we are able to connect. Our anxiety lessens, the goal of love is reestablished, and we gain a supernatural energy to reconnect. The pillar of vision. One of my favorite movies is The Legend of Bagger Vance. The main character, Rudolph Juna, is a promising young golfer who takes the golf circuit by storm in the early 1900s. When World War I breaks out, he is swept away from the life, woman, and game he loves to serve his country. After the war, he returns to Savannah, Georgia, as a shell of the man he once was. Completely derailed, Juna avoids everything he used to love, surviving from one day to the next. Then, after a series of events during the Great Depression, Juna ends up back in the game of golf, representing Savannah in an exhibition game against the two top golfers of his day, Bobby Jones and Walter Hagen. Into this opportunity for redemption walks Bagger Vance, a Holy Spirit-type figure who appears out of nowhere one night before the exhibition as Juna is taking practice shots. Vance starts setting up the ball for Juna. After a series of bad shots, Vance looks up at Juna and says, "You lost your swing. We's got to help you get your swing again, Mr. Juna." With Vance's coaching, Juna indeed finds his swing and makes a brilliant showing at the exhibition. Juna's swing is a metaphor for your identity and calling, what you were created to be and to do. As Bagger Vance did for Juna, the Holy Spirit is committed to helping you find your swing. But at the end of the day, you are the one holding the club. No one else can fulfill your potential. You have to embark on your own quest to discover why you are on this planet, what makes you get out of bed in the morning, and what you uniquely contribute to the world. Along with a personal vision, a couple needs a shared vision if they're going to have a healthy relationship. Some couples have the vision to create the ideal Christian marriage. Other couples want to create a $100 million business together. Others want to serve in Sudan. Whatever the goal, a shared vision is necessary in order to move together in managing your priorities and preserving unity. You do not want to be on a plane to China, meet someone during your layover in New York who is headed to Australia, fall in love, marry that person, change your flight to Australia, and decide 5 years later that you were supposed to be in China. Instead, just find somebody on a plane to China. Some people never gain a vision for their identity and calling and stumble blindly and aimlessly through life, existing at the level of survival. Others do get a vision, but lose sight of it through traumatic events, as Juna did, or through their own neglect. Proverbs 29:18 says, "Where there is no vision, the people perish." One of the reasons people perish without a vision is that they cannot endure the pain and cost required to achieve any worthwhile purpose. Only vision can give a purpose to your pain, which enables you to endure it and reach your goal. Christ demonstrated this incredible power of vision to help us endure. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross. One of the marks of powerful people is that they proactively establish practices and build relationships that help renew their vision and remind them of who they are. When two people establish the pillar of vision in their relationship, they share the knowledge of one another's identity and calling, as well as their joint vision, and remind one another of those things on a regular basis. When seasons of difficulty, pain, or loss come up, the pillar of vision strengthens a relational connection and protects it from being thrown into survival mode. Creating an environment for shalom. When you and another person lay a firm foundation of unconditional love and acceptance and actively build the pillars of love, honor, self-control, responsibility, truth, faith, and vision in your connection, you raise a structure that can protect and cultivate an environment of shalom. Shalom is a powerful Hebrew word that encompasses the flourishing of divine order, divine health, and divine prosperity in your life. It means that every part of your life, body, soul, spirit, relationships, dreams, and work, is being nourished and is growing and thriving. Shalom is literally the reality of God's kingdom of righteousness, peace, and joy being expressed in your life. Do you want the highest level of quality in your connections with other people? Do you want relationships that invite shalom? Then I encourage you to go after each of the architectural elements we've explored in this chapter. Examine your current thinking and behavior in each of these areas. Ask yourself, can my spouse or friends truly be themselves around me? Am I moving toward the people I love no matter what? Am I showing them the truth of my heart? Am I able to respond well in any situation? Or do I react and blame my choices on external forces? Remember, nobody can manage your love but you. Nobody can manage your honor but you. Nobody can manage your truth but you. Nobody can manage your self-control or responsibility but you. And nobody can manage your vision and your faith but you. The quality of what you are building is ultimately up to you. Section 2, Communication. Chapter 5, Communication, Exchanging the Truth Inside. Communication exposes what is going on inside the human heart. Jesus said, "For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks." If your heart, your internal reality, is governed by fear, then you're going to telegraph that through your body language, facial expressions, words, and tone. Conversely, if your heart is governed by faith, hope, and love, you will release this reality through what you say and how you say it. If your heart is governed by fear, then much of what you communicate is actually designed to hide what is really going on inside. You hold back, pretend something doesn't hurt, or act happy when your heart is breaking in an attempt to avoid the pain that being real can inflict. It's also possible that you, like many, were never taught how to interpret and translate the language of your thoughts, emotions, and desires into words, let alone communicate with others. As a result, your internal reality has never been validated. Now ashamed and fearful, the results of not knowing how to communicate your feelings, you hide behind an acceptable social mask. Fear of truth is the great hijacker of communication. When you don't have either the courage or the ability to face the truth of what you feel, think, and need, you end up communicating confusing and inaccurate information, sometimes even downright falsehoods. Ask yourself these two questions. Number one, if you never really learn to value and understand what's going on inside of you, how can you value and understand what is going on with another person? Number two, if you don't know yourself, how can you get to know another person, someone with a completely different experience and perspective, and value the truth of who they are? The answer to both questions is simple. You can't. Only those who value and understand themselves can value and understand others. Only those who can communicate honestly with themselves can communicate honestly with others. These are both traits of a powerful person. Unless you become a powerful person who values what is going on in your heart, your experience with communication is guaranteed to be an endless sequence of misunderstandings and being misunderstood. Powerless people communicate out of the fear of truth, and they primarily do it in one of three styles: passive communication, aggressive communication, or passive-aggressive communication. As you'll see, each of these styles traces back to false core beliefs about the values of what is inside a person. Worse, they cultivate fear and destroy connection because they provide a way for people not to tell the truth. Passive communication. Passive communicators attempt to convince the world that everyone else is more important than they are. Their core belief is, you matter, I don't. When faced with a joint decision in a relationship, the passive person insists that the other person's thoughts, feelings, and needs matter more. If they believe that their feelings, thoughts, and needs are being disrespected, they will simply try to absorb it and move on. Passive communicators say things like, "Oh, whatever you want. No, that's okay. No, that didn't hurt. No, I'm fine. No, I know you were just upset. No, I don't need to talk about this anymore. I'm good. No, I don't care where we go, wherever you want. I'm fine. No, I'm great." Passive people justify devaluing themselves by painting themselves as long-suffering, patient servants who keep the peace and don't ever make problems. They think it's right to have no needs or requirements. In reality, they are lying cowards. If I am a passive communicator, then I will lie because I'm afraid of what you will do if you find out I do have needs. I'm afraid of being punished for telling the truth. I'm afraid of communicating what's going on with me because I'm afraid you'll think I'm a bad person, or worse, I'm selfish. Somehow, I actually believe that it is noble to hide myself from the relationship. But I'm only feeding my own anxiety by ensuring that you will never know the truth inside me. You will never be dealing with the real me. You will always be dealing with the facade. And of course, the passive approach, being a lie, is impossible to maintain in the long term. The bitterness that grows by absorbing the other person's selfishness will ultimately make a passive person more miserable than scared, and so they will take action. They will stop being passive and will probably end the relationship so that their need will finally be met. The problem is that the passive person has been just as selfish as the one toward whom they're bitter. They devalued their own needs, not out of a desire to benefit the other person, but out of self-protection. I know two sisters, one lent the other a moderate sum of money. Days turned into weeks, weeks turned into months, months turned into years, and still the one sister did not pay back the sum of money. The sister who loaned the money, the ultimate passive communicator, was inwardly seething, but she never confronted her sister about it. She wanted to maintain peace. She abhorred confrontation, and since she didn't need the money, she did not feel like her need to be repaid was valuable enough to be addressed. Nevertheless, by year 7, she couldn't take it anymore and decided that she would just sue her sister. There is little peace in the family now. Hurt has skyrocketed on both sides, and connection might be irreparably damaged. This is not healthy communication. Aggressive communication. The aggressive communicator is like the T-Rex. Their core belief is, I matter, you don't. Aggressive communicators know how to get what they want. They are large and in charge because they are the biggest, loudest, scariest one in the room. If we were to line up a communication food chain, the aggressive communicator would be the T-Rex at the top, and the passive communicator would be a goat cowering at the bottom. The craziest thing happens, though. The T-Rex and the goat end up in a relationship together. How in the world does this happen? Simple. They both agree on something. The T-Rex matters and the goat doesn't. What a pair. This communication dynamic sends anxiety through the roof because the unequal value and power balance entirely eliminates intimacy. It can only be a relationship of survival. The T-Rex will get what he needs by taking it, and the goat will get what she needs by giving away body parts to the T-Rex. In the end, the goat will no longer exist, and the T-Rex will still be hungry. Both are motivated by fear and selfishness, and both are powerless. Passive-aggressive communication. The passive-aggressive communication style is the most sophisticated, and therefore the most devious of the fear-based communication styles. It is the worst of being passive and the worst of being aggressive. The passive-aggressive communicator's core belief is, you matter, no, not really. They manipulate and control others through active deceit and subtle but deadly forms of punishment. To your face, they say, oh, whatever you need, absolutely. Then, after your little disagreement, they head outside and key your car. The passive-aggressive communicator is famous for sarcastic innuendos, veiled threats, the manipulative use of scriptures, judgments that come in the form of counsel, and withholding love. The passive-aggressive communicators maintain a veneer of civility. It is often hard for people on the outside to understand why someone has such a difficult time being in a relationship with them. Someone who is trying to gain counsel about dealing with a passive-aggressive person looks crazy, because they are the only one who perceives all the hostility and manipulation directed toward them. To everyone else, the passive-aggressive person is kind and bubbly and smiling all the time. They don't know that the second they get behind closed doors, he or she is insinuating, criticizing, accusing, stonewalling, and sending mixed messages that would drive anyone insane. I describe a passive-aggressive communicator as a chocolate-covered dragon. Sometimes women are attracted to men who appear charming and romantic, flattering them incessantly, and who are just plain too good to be true. It's not until women get into deeper relationships with these passive-aggressive men that they learn that they are actually chocolate-covered dragons. Once the nice facade is gone, they become vicious manipulators who discount these women's thoughts and feelings. They are often jealous of anything the women do that does not revolve around them. I once knew a chocolate-covered dragon